you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
I'm Tracy Thomas, host of One for the Books, a live literary event series from LAist. We are back with guests, author Amanda Montell, and actor Bella Lavelle. You can find us on May 15th at the Crawford Family Forum. Tickets at laist.com/events.
Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Just a reminder, tomorrow in our 11 o'clock hour, it's Film Week, of course, and we'll hear what our critics have to say about the latest Purge film, The Forever Purge. Also, the animated Boss Baby Family Business, a number in that series of films, and a remastered re-release of the classic from 1955, Britain's Ealing Studios, The Lady Killers, starring Alec Guinness, Peter Sellers, Herbert Lom, and many other favorite great British actors. We'll hear about those films and many more. That comes up tomorrow on Film Week, 11 o'clock, right here on KPCC. This morning, two very big and final decisions from the U.S. Supreme Court with the conclusion of its term. Joining us to talk about the cases is Vikram Amar, Dean and Professor of Law at the University of Illinois College of Law, and David Becker, Executive Director and Founder of the Center for Election Innovation and Research. He was a senior trial attorney at the Justice Department's voting section in the Civil Rights Division as well. Dean Amar, great to have you back with us again on Air Talk. We appreciate it. Let's talk first about the Arizona voting case and what the Republican majority legislature did there, which has now been upheld by the Supreme Court.
Sure. Thank you for having me, Larry. There were two provisions of Arizona law at issue in today's ruling. One requires voters, when they vote in person, to vote at a particular precinct, which makes sense because you don't want all the people in the state showing up at the same polling place. But what Arizona said was, if you are a registered voter and you vote at the wrong precinct, you don't get to have any of the votes that you cast, even for statewide offices that would have been the same no matter where you'd voted, count. So obviously you can't vote for local measures that you don't have any right to because you don't live in the relevant jurisdiction. But the question was, why should your vote for statewide offices not count? And the court upheld that provision, saying that the state has an interest in encouraging people to show up at the right polling places. The other provision prohibited the collection or harvesting, if you will, of ballots by people other than the voters themselves or their family members or registered assistants. For example, you couldn't go around and say, look, anyone who wants to vote, just fill out your ballot and I'll collect the vote and I'll drop it off for you. And the court upheld that provision on the ground that the state has an interest in preventing election fraud. Even if there's no evidence of fraud at the moment, they can act in advance of any fraud that takes place. And in both of these instances, the court pointed to the fact that there are lots of ways to vote in Arizona properly, and it's pretty easy to vote there. And so the court didn't think that the state was up to no good, even though certainly the first provision, the out-of-precinct provision, did affect minority groups differently than whites. About 1% of people of color voted in the wrong precinct, and only about 0.5% of whites did. And what the court said is, well, the difference between 1% and 0.5% isn't that much, although you could look at it another way and say it's twice as big. So the court didn't rewrite the Voting Rights Act in a major way today, and they did what most people expected. But they definitely, made it easier for Arizona to regulate voting in the ways we just described.
David Becker, how does this affect future voting restrictions? Because I'm wondering about how this particularly affects the Voting Rights Act and the concept that a disproportionate effect on a minority group is something that is actionable by the feds, whether it's intentional or not, versus whether that disproportionality in result is intentionally done for a political benefit or with the intent to disenfranchise. Did that issue get addressed here?
This case was primarily about the impact, the disparate impact of the case. And in fact, many observers think that's one of the reasons that the Justice Department, when they recently sued Georgia under its new law, focused more on the purpose, the discriminatory intent that may have been behind that law. In this case, Dina Maher is quite right. The two issues were about the delivery of ballots by third parties and whether provisional ballots get counted if they're cast out of precinct. I do want to note these are laws that were passed well before the 2020 election that were in place. And I think although most observers, including myself, did expect the Supreme Court to rule in favor of the state, they went a little bit farther than they needed to and many expected. They could have ruled similarly to the lower district court and the panel on the Ninth Circuit that these were both proper exercises of state authority, that they didn't rise to the level of creating too big of a disparate impact, and that they were not just factually violations of Section 2. But the 6-3 decision in the Supreme Court today went farther than that. It dismissed the idea of disparate impact to some degree and said that the mere fact, quote unquote, of disparate impact wasn't enough, even whereas here the impact on minorities was perhaps twice as great as on whites, and raised the bar for minority voters in the future to challenge laws of this sort. It further went on and gave the state pretty great latitude in defending any potentially disparate impactful legislation, and said if they can create some kind of argument, perhaps even a pretext of integrity or something else along those lines, that would probably be sufficient to uphold it. I think most of us who have been in the position of enforcing Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act see this as a substantial weakening of the Voting Rights Act that, of course, comes 8 years after the court had already weakened another substantial provision of the Voting Rights Act, effectively eliminating the Section 5 preclearance requirements.
We're talking with David Becker of the Center for Election Innovation and Research. Do any voting restrictions that are enacted by states, do efforts to try and address potential disenfranchisement come into play in these cases? For example, if you've got an ID requirement for someone to vote, and you know that disproportionately a particular racial or ethnic group has less ID able to be shown at a polling place, does then a stated effort to try and remediate that, have people get IDs, things like that, does that at all come into play with things like this?
So in general, yes. There's a totality of the circumstances test that applies, and efforts to mitigate any negative impacts are certainly in play. So for instance, you could see a highly restrictive ID, perhaps limiting it only to a valid driver's license. That might raise more Section 2 concerns under the Voting Rights Act than something that was less restrictive, where you could have a driver's license or maybe one of several other forms of ID, or if you didn't have an ID, you could sign an affidavit. So the totality of the circumstances will be reviewed, but it does appear from this decision the Supreme Court is saying they're going to lessen the consideration of things like disparate impacts, the effect of a law on minority voters being worse than what it is on white voters, and elevating defenses against Section 2 claims that might be, for instance, it relates to election integrity, even if there's not a lot of evidence that there's many integrity benefits.
We're talking with David Becker of the Center for Election Innovation and Research. Also with us is Vikram Amar from the University of Illinois College of Law. He's both professor and dean of the College of Law. We'll continue our conversation coming up in just 1 minute. And if you have questions for our guests, you can ask them at 866-893-KPECC, tweet at AirTalk, or post on the AirTalk Facebook page. The final two cases to be released of the U.S. Supreme Court in the current term, one of them involving Arizona voting restrictions, and the other having to do with a California requirement that the top donors of political contributions have to be disclosed to the state, not with the idea that they would be publicly disclosed, but so that the state would have information it could use to possibly investigate fraud or any sort of violation of voting laws and disclosure laws. With us, the Dean of University of Illinois College of Law, Vic Amar. Dean Amar, what sort of an impact does this decision have?
Well, again, as you pointed out, the law in California requires charitable organizations, not so much political organizations, but charitable organizations to disclose the identities of the major donors. And what a majority of the Supreme Court said over the dissent of Justices Kagan and Breyer and Sotomayor was that when you require disclosure to the government, even if the government is not going to actively make that information public, that can have a chilling effect on the willingness of these private individuals to associate with and give to the charitable organizations. So we have to apply a pretty rigorous test to make sure that the state has a strong enough reason for creating that potential chilling effect. And in this case, the court said that the state of California really didn't have much of a reason for collecting this information. It really wasn't that useful in investigating fraud by charitable organizations. And so the imposition on the would-be donors was not justified by any government interest. Now, what the dissenters said was, you know, you're treating this the same way we treated cases from the 1960s when the government would ask, for example, the NAACP to turn over its membership lists in a way that obviously could cause some people to worry about government or private reprisal. And there's not really a reason to fear any kind of negative consequences just because you give the information to the government in this arena compared to that arena. So a lot of this has to do with how worried we are that there will be a chilling effect on the association rights of the would-be donors. But this is, I think, another example of how the First Amendment is really the darling of the Supreme Court in the past two decades. If you look at all the constitutional rights that have been asserted, free speech and freedom of association are the ones that tend to collect five, six, seven or more votes in recent decades. And in the past handful of years, the liberals, especially Justice Kagan and Sotomayor and Breyer, have been dissenting from some of these applications of the First Amendment because, and this case is a good example of this, whereas in the past, the First Amendment was deployed to protect more progressive individuals and organizations that were on the fringe of the mainstream, whether it's communists or flag burners or advocates for civil rights. Now, the First Amendment is often being invoked on behalf of more conservative and more majoritarian institutions. And the liberals are realizing that that's not such a great thing for some of the larger values that they support. Hence, we had a 6-3 breakdown in this case today.
Although it's interesting, wasn't the ACLU in favor of just the decision that the court made?
Well, the ACLU is institutionally in a difficult, or an interesting, I should say, position, because it has always been so dedicated to First Amendment, freedom of association, and the like. But today, we see a lot more clashes between freedom of speech on the one hand and potential damage to equality norms or, say, reproductive autonomy, liberty norms on the other hand. So I like that the ACLU is clinging to its free speech roots, but it's a complicated moment for that organization, as many press accounts have chronicled.
Well, in California, making the argument that it needs to have this information about the major donors for potential investigations, was the state, to your knowledge, able to show that it actually did use that information and successfully go after charitable organizations that were fraudulent?
Well, indeed, the opposite. The court said that there was not much of a track record of the state actually using these disclosures as a basis for triggering or pursuing investigations. And to the extent that there are other things about a charitable organization that justify some kind of an investigation into it, there are plenty of other methods that the state can use to get this donor information if it needs it down the road, as opposed to collecting it up front in the form of this blunderbuss form.
I also wonder about, just, we've had so many cases of what was supposed to be confidential information, because California wasn't arguing here that this should be public. They were arguing that they needed it and that they would keep it private. But we've just had the tax returns of a number of super wealthy Americans somehow leak from the IRS, presumably. And we've had hacking of private accounts with information released publicly. Did the justices get it all to that sort of practical side of this?
Well, I can't recall. I read the opinion very quickly. It just came out a few hours ago. I can't recall whether they invoked that particular analogy. But I think your big point is certainly a valid one, which is we live in a world where, you know, it's harder to trust that information that's given confidentially will remain confidential. And that's true even when it's given to the government. But then second and relatedly, even if, objectively speaking, the government does a good job of maintaining confidences, there's the question of whether people believe that. And we live in a world where people are very distrustful of institutions, including government. And so in terms of the chilling effect that the court is worried about laws like this having on associational and donational activity, the court might be taking into account not just the reality of potential disclosure, but the fear on behalf of a lot of individuals.
There are a number of Democrats and progressives specifically who have urged that Justice Breyer should retire so that it would be certain that Democratic President Joe Biden would be able to nominate his successor. Do you have any sense of whether he might be looking to retire?
My guess, and it's just a guess, is that he will probably step down either, you know, in the coming days or weeks this year or a year from now. You know, there's really not much difference between now and a year from now. The Democrats are still going to control the Senate in the summer of 2022, unless one of the Democratic senators from a red state were somehow to die or become incapacitated and be replaced by a Republican governor. Even if that were the case, I think you have Republican senators like Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, who would want to give a floor vote to any Democratic nominee. So I think there's, you know, maybe a 50-50 chance he does it in the coming weeks and a 50-50 chance he does it next year. Remember, Justice Breyer has not been in the position that he's in now very long. He's now the most senior justice in an albeit smaller, more liberal wing of the court. Made up of himself and Justices Kagan and Sotomayor. But he didn't occupy that position for a long time, because when he arrived, Justice Stevens was the senior justice on the left.
So I thank you so much, Dean Amar. I'm so sorry I'm out of time. David Becker, thank you too. It's Air Talk.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at las.com/sweeps.